and gentlemen, we invite you to listen to that famous commentator of present world days, Lord O'Hara, speaking to England.
Just gone by. It began with a feeling of tension and suspense. The great offensive against France had been brought to a victorious conclusion. The French had laid down arms, and throughout the world people wondered when the final act, the offensive against British soil, would come. In Germany, and many other countries, particularly in England, there was a firm conviction that it would come soon. And that conviction remained. The day and the hour are the Führer's secret. And he has returned in triumph to Berlin. Amid scenes of unprecedented rejoicing, and we enter into a week that may be even more sensational than any we have yet experienced. The great exodus from Britain is well underway. The rich and affluent are removing themselves and their valuables as fast as they can. Great stretches of the coastline have been evacuated to a depth of 20 miles. Hastily improvised defenses are being erected, which are things of papier-mâché and cardboard in comparison with the Maginot Line and the forts of Liège. The city is quaking, and whilst genuine business has practically come to a standstill in London, speculators are enjoying a brief paradise. There is naturally a strong prejudice in favor of spot cash dealing. None of the sharks wants to take the risk of waiting for settlement day. The political prisoners who have been arrested and thrown into jail without trial are, it is said, to be transported to Canada. Thus a fresh crime has been perpetrated by the corrupt dictator of England against men and women. Were bad to say in time that peace offered the only hope for their country. Indeed, the land of democratic liberty presents a macabre picture today. Dissolution hovers over its moribund institution, and the smell of decay is in the air. Whilst the great question of the hour remains as yet unanswered, this last week has been fertile in one respect. It has produced the most crashing blow that has ever been delivered at Britain's prestige. And that blow, interesting to relate, has been delivered not by the Führer, but by Winston Churchill, the aged satyr, whose talent for injuring those who trust him is unique. With the murderous attack by a British naval squadron on the French ships at Oran, Churchill's last claim to be treated as a human being vanishes. The spectacle of the Royal Navy firing on French warships that were not under steam and could not maneuver is the worthy sequel to the criminal attack on the Altmark in Jerseyfjord. An attack, by the way, which has been fully and justly avenged. Before, however, we examine this most disgraceful act in English history, we had better look at its antecedents. The German forces succeeded in capturing the French military archives on the Loire. The documents which were seized have proved infinitely revealing. They show, amongst other things, how the British government proposed to involve Scandinavia, the Balkans, and Turkey in war with Germany, and even outline measures of coercion which were to have been adopted to this end. They mention plans for the bombing of Batum and Baku. They demonstrate how, if Mr. Churchill had had his way, these neutral countries would have been ravaged by the horrors of war. But, as you now know, all these plans and schemes went awry. The gallant beginning which Churchill made in Scandinavia resulted in the headlong flight of the British forces from Norway, and the design to invade the Ruhr produced in 6 weeks the surrender of Holland, Belgium, and France. The captured archives, however, are extremely interesting from another point of view. They show the miserable, niggardly, grudging, and altogether ineffectual help which Churchill placed at the disposal of his unfortunate allies. If he and his colleagues had said at the beginning of last September that they had no intention of making any real contribution to the defense of France, the French would have known exactly where they stood. On the contrary, they were assured with lavish professions of false affection that Britain would stand by them with her whole power. We have already had something to say about the glorious retreat of the British expeditionary force from Flanders. And we have previously commented, I think, on the fact that Churchill could not or would not muster up more than 10 divisions to take part in the Battle of France, although in the World War it had been possible for England to provide 85. But until we had documentary evidence to the contrary, it might have been possible for the Ministry of Information to state, with however little plausibility, that the measure of support which Britain was contributing was in accordance with some sort of agreement between the British and French general staff. Now we know that no such concord existed. On the contrary, the inner history of the relations between the two governments and the two commands is one long story of appeals for help on the French side and callous refusal or evasion on the British. Let me give a few examples from the correspondence. On May the 15th, General Gamelin wired to Air Marshal Newall for 10 squadrons of British planes. The next day, he found it necessary to prefer the same request to Mr. Churchill. He did so in insistent language and reminded the British Prime Minister that he had asked for them before. This telegram went at 10:30 in the morning. At 2:30 in the afternoon, he had to send another telegram to the same noble friend of La Belle France. It did no more good than the other two. On May the 17th, he wired to Churchill again, this time demanding that the Royal Air Force should make its contribution to the Battle of France and pointing out that the position of the French troops was one of extreme peril. 7 days later came a complaint from Churchill to the effect that the French general staff was not cooperating adequately with the British. On May the 30th, General Vigon telegraphed to the British High Command his most insistent request that the British Air Forces, which had retired to England, should be sent back to France. On June the 3rd, General Vermont saw the end coming. He begged Monsieur Renault to use all his influence with Churchill to secure the assistance of the Royal Air Force. He might as well have saved himself the trouble of writing the dispatch. Now, these are but a few instances out of many. They are typical of the whole. And after reading these documents, I wonder why the French commanders should have felt themselves under any obligation whatsoever to the British government. And even more, why Churchill had the brazen insolence to tell the world that he could not see any reason why Marshal Pétain should have asked for terms, or why the French should have laid down arms. This miserable protégé of Barney Barrow knows better than anybody else in the world the story of the French defeat. He was warned again and again of what would happen. But when patriotic Frenchmen decided that their armies could fight no longer, and that it was their duty to save as much of France as they could, the degenerate of Downing Street turned upon men whom he had been lauding to the skies and hurled at them reproaches as unjust as they were undignified. He went further, and in the futile hope of disturbing the armistice at whatever cost to the French people, he set up a freak French government in London, making a cashiered and disgraced officer, or should we say ex-officer, to be precise, the head of any and all Frenchmen who were prepared to betray their country and follow him. The futile idiocy of this ridiculous and spiteful act soon became apparent. The English people saw through it and realized that this handful of renegades no more represented France than they represented China. The British public was nervous and demoralized. Something had to be done. It was necessary to score a propaganda success at any price. Therefore, hoping the bluff might be sufficient to serve the purpose, Churchill ordered the British Navy to seize certain French naval units which lay within its reach. The French commanders, in loyalty to the armistice, decided to reject Churchill's impudent request. Thereupon, in accordance with Churchill's orders, British ships and planes opened fire on the French vessels, inflicting, as we are told, heavy casualties. Only a small fraction of the French fleet was involved. But as it was attacked at a disadvantage, there was much bloodshed, which was dutifully cheered by the House of Commons. Depravity could scarcely go any further. These fat and pompous plutocrats behaved as if they had scored a great victory over Germany, instead of making a treacherous attack on their fallen allies. I cannot help remembering how in Henry IV, Falstaff feigned death whilst the combat was raging about him, but when the fighting had ceased, raised his head cautiously and crept over to the prostrate body of Hotspur, and then stabbed it in the thigh with his knife. This noble act having been performed, he went off to claim the chief honors of the battle.